traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Before we start this podcast, I wanted to take the opportunity to tell you about a very exciting offer that I have created. I am referring here to the premium subscription option, where for the low price of $8 per month, you get access to a whole bunch of things. You can check out exactly what is offered at the website contrarian.supercast.tech. The benefits include access to podcasts that are ad-free and don't have any of these annoying announcements. You get access to podcast episodes a full day earlier than you would otherwise. You also get transcripts of podcasts. And there are a number of locked groups that I have started on our Discord server and on our Slack channel, where we will have guests for AMAs and other things, all of which is only accessible to premium members. If that weren't enough, you also get discounts on partnership subscriptions, such as Breakout Point and ValueWalk premium subscriptions. And last, but by no means least, you even get a Contrarian coffee mug as a thank you for signing up. Again, the website is contrarian.supercast.tech. That's T like tango, E-C-H. Check it out and sign up today. Now on to today's podcast. Alex Jaworzowski of ITR Economics, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. The topic of today is this economic recovery. And the current narrative, if I dare to say, that has kind of at this point taken hold, is that this recovery is not really on very firm footing. That we've seen just recently in September now some hiccups, especially from tech stocks. You hear a lot about how valuations are extremely rich and potentially even overvalued, even in light of this last correction in the tech sector. And that, you know, again, maybe the U.S. consumer will not return in full force. The jobs, especially in employment picture, is not on very firm footing. So that I would say it's fair to say that is at least one prevailing view that has taken hold here as we record this on September 17th. But your view is it goes against that, and you actually have reasons to be a little bit more optimistic about this economic recovery. So tell me about that.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways that you can look at this. And I'm going to try to keep it fairly top level by, first of all, addressing the very real downside risks that still exist to the economy. We are obviously heading into the flu season, into the colder winter months. We have no way of knowing how the pandemic is going to behave when it combines with the flu season, whether or not we're going to have a huge upswell in cases and in deaths and hospitalization rates. But basically what we're tracking on the COVID side right now is that the data is painting a relatively favorable picture. The case counts are down over the last 6 weeks, and in some cases quite significantly. So if you look at kind of the mid-July timeframe, we were averaging about 70,000 cases per day. We're now averaging somewhere around the 35,000 mark. So it's still a high number, but not nearly as scary as what was going on in the summer months. If we look at deaths, they have pulled back. And again, not anywhere near the original swell that we had during that March, April, May timeframe. So that's encouraging. And really, when it comes to talking about the economic impact of the pandemic, what you have to understand is it's not the cases or the deaths or the hospitalization rates that determine the impact. It's how we react to those, to that information. And what we're seeing is that it is extremely unlikely at this point that we have the same kind of countrywide or statewide shutdowns that really kind of crippled the economy in the second half or second quarter of the year. So our premise for the recovery to building momentum from this point on onward is assuming that we do not have the same kind of stay-at-home orders or sector-wide shutdowns that we saw in early 2020. The other component that I think should be mentioned here as a risk factor is the absence of government stimulus, right? We had a large part of the green shoots of recovery, if you will, had to do with the direct payments to individuals. They had to do with the additional unemployment benefits and certainly the PPP program, providing what is essentially a liquidity bridge for both consumers and businesses to get past the chasm of the pandemic, right? Right now, there is obviously squabbling going on Capitol Hill. The Democrats want support for state and local governments. Yeah, to put it mildly. The Republican contingent, they want to focus more on business liability protections. They want to get more money to businesses. And so there's a disagreement in that sense, but there is a bipartisan support that more stimulus is needed. So we are encouraged by that sentiment, and we think that there is going to be additional government support for the economy as they try to mitigate some of the worst impact of the pandemic. So having addressed those kind of downside risk factors that could potentially derail the economy, what I can talk to you about are signals that the recovery is going to very likely continue. Mm-hmm. What we do at ITR Economics is we use a system of leading indicators that consistently and accurately predict the, what's happening in the economic cycle as far as 12 to 18 months into the future. And the good news there is that our tried and true system of leading indicators right now, the top dozen or so, are all consistently pointing to rise once we get into 2021. Business cycle rise, that means recovery off of the low point and then some growth in the second half of next year. So when you look at the specifics of that, the particular strength right now is actually coming from the consumer. And you talked about some of the weakening signs that we've seen recently, but the good news that I can share with you is if you look at the aspects of the economy that are heavily reliant on the consumer, that being the housing market, for example, or retail sales, or the shipment of goods all around the country, they're consistently up, not only off of the low points that we saw back in March and April, but they're actually up year over year. For example, just yesterday, we got the retail sales data at the nationwide level for the month of August, and we now have three consecutive months where there has been not only growth relative to the low point in the cycle earlier this year, but it's been year-over-year growth. So June, July, and August are all above their same levels seen in 2019, which is really phenomenal, right? When you think about what typically happens in a recession, you don't have consumers spending more money than they spent last year. You don't have consumers with higher disposable personal incomes the way that we've seen over the summer months. And so I guess the main argument that I'll make here is the resiliency of the consumer coupled with the strength that we're seeing in the housing market all point to a very favorable economic performance in 2021.
Okay. All right. So I'm curious now, what are these indicators that you track? How many are there? You don't have to talk through all of them, but what are some of the most, you mentioned the consumer, and what are some other ones?
Yeah, so there are a plethora of indicators. We track hundreds upon thousands of series, but the ones that I find the most indicative, the ones that have the highest correlation and the longest predictive abilities, tend to be focused in the proprietary indicators that we have at ITR Economics, things that we developed ourselves. But if I were to give you some specific examples, things like the Purchasing Managers Index, that's typically a really good indication of what's happening about 12 months into the future. Basically, people's opinions about the purchasing decisions they're going to be making over the next several years. We look at things like utilization rates. So that means that if you look at the current percentage of infrastructure, factory space, and people that we're using to meet the current levels of demand. If those utilization rates are rising, that means that there's going to be some impetus down the road for more investment, more purchasing to happen. Mm-hmm. Exports, the housing market is a great 12-month leading indicator to the overall economic cycle in the United States. We look at trade and all sorts of different matrices, but I would say that those are kind of the, some of the favorite ones that we tend to leverage.
One you didn't mention was employment. How does that not factor in so much?
So it's very interesting you asked about employment, because that's actually a lagging indicator. What we do is we look for series that have future predictive ability, but unemployment and employment numbers typically lag the economic cycle, right? Once businesses start to see their revenues fall off a cliff, then you have several months or several quarters later that you have unemployment ranks swell. So mm-hmm. it typically follows the economic cycle, which is why we're not really looking at that as a predictive ability. We're looking at it more as a response to what's going on in the economy. But I will say that our outlook for employment is certainly one that reflects the challenges that we face. We think that by the second half of next year, for example, we still have an additional 3 to 5 million people in the unemployment ranks that we did not have back in early 2020. So it's going to continue to come back. It'll do so relatively slowly. But I will say that even those figures have been surprisingly positive. Because if you remember, we had an unemployment rate peak somewhere around 15% earlier this year, and we are now at 8% essentially 6 months later. So that's a fairly robust rebound that we see in that employment market. Mm-hmm. Not all industries and sectors are behaving the same way. Obviously, the retail environment, food service, anything related to travel and leisure, they're lagging behind because we haven't gotten back to life as normal yet. But if you look at manufacturing, for example, you know, which accounts for a substantial part of the economy, when you look at services, software, and really the professional environment, that's been extremely resilient in the face of this crisis.
Very interesting. Yeah. And certainly, you know, as we know, the U.S. consumer props up the entire most of the global economy. And if U.S. Citizens are buying stuff in large numbers and increasing those purchases, it generally bodes well for the global economy. And then if people are buying homes in the US, it's an even better indicator. So yeah, so those are two things in your favor, but for sure. Now there is another big thing that we are all looking out for here and anticipating. And obviously it's in the news every single minute of every single day. And I am referring here to the election, of course. Do you have any views on that? Because there are some things that I hear about how, especially if there is a contested election, if one side or the other or both or somehow create some kind of ruckus with this not accepted, or if there is no clear outcome, or if somehow this thing gets dragged out and there's uncertainty and unrest potentially, that could really kind of screw things up.
Yeah, certainly is a major topic of conversation for us with our clients right now. Right. I'll separate my answer in two components here. The first one is to answer your question regarding the contested election possibility. Mm. What I would say is, if that does happen, and it's still a very big if at this point, then I would chalk that up to kind of as a black swan event type of thing. Right. It's really difficult to predict what the outcome of that will be. We really haven't had something like that happen, certainly not in recent history. And it's very tough to try to forecast what that means from an economic perspective, because you have to layer assumption upon assumption upon assumption, right? And at that point, it's just a guessing game. But I can tell you that when we look at the impact of elections in general, what we find is that there's actually fairly little immediate impact for the economy. What I mean by that is that it's not about the party that gets elected into power. If you look at, for example, GDP growth a year after each of the presidential elections since 1950, it's essentially the same, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat in the White House, roughly 2.8%. So kind of a rounding error. The economy essentially has no preference for one party affiliation or another. Right. What really makes a difference is policy, right? And you can understand that it takes time to pass significant pieces of policy, and then it takes more time for that policy to kind of unfold and really start to impact the economic cycle. And the 2016 election is actually a perfect example of this. So back on the campaign trail in mid-2016, President Trump had a lot of big ticket items on the agenda. There was healthcare reform and immigration reform and infrastructure and trade and taxes, right? And it wasn't until a full 2 years later in 2018 that we had the first meaningful piece of policy actually get signed into law, which was, of course, trade and the tax reform package.
Right.
Now, it took another 6 months from that point for it to actually affect the economic cycle in the United States to the positive, right? Especially on the taxes side. So what we're saying is that the outcome of both the economy and likely, you know, in the longer term, the market itself is going to be unaffected by the immediate implications of the election. It's likely going to be visible kind of in the late 2021, maybe into the 22 timeframe, but certainly we're not looking to change our forecast for economic performance for 2021 based on who wins in the November presidential election.
And is that true even if Biden wins and the Democrats take back the Senate? Because if that happens, one would think that, you know, there is the chances for some kind of, you know, be it higher taxes, more regulation, the types of things that many economists, not all, but many say are kind of a drag on the economic growth. So would that hold true then, even then?
I would say certainly if we do have that scenario unfold where Biden wins the presidency and there is a takeover of the Senate by the Democrats, and so they have, you know, control over essentially, you know, the decision-making branches of government, then the probability of Biden's tax proposal, for example, going through is going to become much more likely, right? But that's a huge if. It, again, relies on a lot of assumptions. So at this point, we are not thinking that that's a default by any means that happens. But the interesting thing that I think people tend to misrepresent sometimes is the relationship between economic performance and tax rates. So, for example, if you look back at the tax proposal by President Trump, when we lowered that corporate tax rate significantly from 35% down to 21%, right, we didn't really see a huge additional swell of investment, right? People were paying out more dividends. They gave, you know, they did a lot more stock buybacks, but they didn't invest in a meaningful way that would drive economic growth. And if I remember correctly, Biden's current proposal has the corporate tax rate going from 21 to 28%. So not nearly as far back as what we had prior to the Trump reforms. And so I think that, yes, it has the potential to be a little bit of a headwind to the economy. But I really think people overestimate the impact that that has, because businesses are driven by things like capacity planning. If they need that machine, they're going to buy it, whether or not the taxation of it is going to be 21% or 28%. And I think that when you look at our expectations for the cycle, which is to say that demand should see a healthy recovery over the next 12 to 18 months, companies are going to need that capacity to meet that demand. We're already seeing some segments of the economy run up against those capacity constraints. So I think that changing in the tax environment is not really going to be as significant of an impact from an economic perspective as many people believe.
Fair points. Okay. All right. Alex Janosowski, ITR Economics. I want to take a short break and come back and ask you a number of other things. But let's first pause here and take a quick break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Okay, welcome back. I'm here with Alex Chazovsky of ITR Economics. Alex, this is the segment of the show where our guest tells us a little bit more about themselves and how they came to their present station in life, if you will. So curious about, you know, your background and your education and experience and all of that, you know, not going back too far, you know, grade school and things like that aren't particularly interesting. But you know, higher education and such, and obviously experience, and how you came to this role at ITR. It would also be interesting if, as a follow-up to that, you go into a little bit what went into developing these models that you guys have.
Absolutely. So going back to the beginnings, I was born in Kiev, Ukraine, which when it was still part of the Soviet Union, and I emigrated to the US when I was 10 years old. Part of that process was we were refugees for about a year and a half. So I spent time living in Austria and in Italy before the United States opened its doors and welcomed us in. But I can tell you that as soon as I arrived here, and our first point of demarcation was Dallas, Texas, I fell in love with capitalism. I have to tell you, it's really a phenomenal thing. I think people really don't give it credit for how awesome we have it here in the United States. We love to focus on all the problems and all the challenges we face, but you know, the opportunities that are available to people in this country are really remarkable. If you're willing to work hard, if you're willing to do what other people aren't willing to do and really kind of devote yourself to becoming the best version of yourself, I think that's really phenomenal to me. So I hope that your audience can share their enthusiasm and their appreciation of the kind of opportunities that they themselves have had. So I mentioned we landed in Dallas. It was obviously a very big acclimation to get used to not only the Texas culture, but also the heat of the environment. So I spent the first few years attending middle school and then high school. And when it came time for me to go to college, I was accepted to many different Ivy League institutions, including Columbia and others. But we were very poor. And so even with a 50% scholarship, I simply didn't have the money to go to those places. And so I chose to go to the University of Texas at Austin, which is a great school, my alma mater, Hook 'em Horns. And I got a full ride for the initial period. And my first entry point into the education, I was an undeclared med school kind of target. But I quickly realized that that was not the life for me. I wanted a good balance of family stuff. And so I switched to business. And so I got my undergraduate degree in international business from Texas. A couple of years later, I got my MBA from the cheaper yet just as good Texas State University just down the road in San Marcos, Texas. And, you know, entered the business world doing a lot of different things. I wasn't really sure what my calling was. So I spent some time, my first job out of school was working at Bank of America as a commercial teller and kind of small business focused. I then moved on and spent some time in sales at Dell. So I was responsible for selling computers and servers and systems to small businesses. I then worked in marketing at a telecommunications company. And after I finished my MBA, I took a job in the market research world. So I worked for a very small privately owned organization that looked at factory automation and the industrial sector in particular, in terms of doing market sizing and, you know, market share analysis and giving people some expectation of what those markets were going to be doing. I led a pretty big team. I had people in China, in the UK, in South America. And eventually I realized that, you know, I really wanted to be a sole contributor rather than a manager, that the bureaucracy of it all kind of, you know, really dissuaded me from going up that chain in the company. And so I decided to become what we called a thought leader, and my focus area became 3D printing. So I spent a few years really kind of helping companies understand the implications of the technology and really how it applies as a threat or an opportunity to their business. Can they benefit from it? Is it really harmful to them down the road? And so part of that job was actually traveling all around the world and making presentations at conferences about educating people on what the technology is, what it isn't, and what its implications are. So about 10 years ago, I first crossed paths with my colleagues here at ITR Economics in the sense that the principal, the president of the company, was giving a economic presentation at several of the same events where I was speaking about technology and 3D printing. And after one of my presentations, he came up to me and said, you know, we're really looking to grow the team here. I can teach you about the economics aspect of it. I can't teach you to be a good presenter. So why don't you come out to New Hampshire, which is where we're based, check it out and see if you're interested. And so long story short, about 5 years ago in 2015, I picked up my wife and kids, and we moved from Austin, Texas to New Hampshire, which is where ITR Economics is based now. And I spent the last 5 years traveling not only in the US, but globally, and working to deliver economic content, but most importantly, specific company forecasts. What we have the ability to do is actually take a company's revenue stream and forecast that 3 years into the future, which I think makes us very unique. So that's kind of how I got to where I am today. As far as the models, I mentioned earlier in the podcast the leading indicators we do. So what it takes for us to develop a particular forecast for a business or a vertical market per se is a combination of factors. First, we look at the way the data typically behaves. So during a period of decline, for example, how long does that decline last and how low on the amplitude, meaning the rates of change, how far do they drop? During a period of rise, what does that typically look like? And how do we choose various scenarios based on what we think is going on right now compared to what has happened in that company in the future? But really, the crux of what we do is leverage those economic indicators that I mentioned earlier to predict turns in the business cycle. Mm-hmm. Because it's those turns, the low points and the high points, that we believe coincide with the most important decision making. We think that business decisions are actually very similar to what you would do in the stock market. You've got to buy low and sell high. That means that you've got to aggressively invest in the future growth of your business at the low point, which, as I mentioned earlier, we see coming up in the near-term future. You've got to position your business to take full advantage of that rising trend and then recognize when you're about to top out and then start pulling that belt a little bit, cutting back on spending, being a little bit more defensive. And so that's the notion of how we approach company forecasting, is helping people understand and see around the corner of when those turns are going to come, and then giving them specific actionable advice of what they should be doing in order to reflect those type of market conditions.
That's really interesting. You said something in the middle there that I want to follow up on, which is the individual companies and their revenue growth 3 years into the future. Is there anything there that you can tell us that might be of interest to this listenership, many of whom are invested in the stock market?
Yes, I think there is something that I really think is important for people to understand. Folks like to put a letter shape to the recovery profile. So people talk about V shapes, U shapes, L shapes, right? But I think the real truth here is the way that you look at the data. So for example, our forecast for the rebound when it comes to the rates of change is more of a V-shaped recovery, right? And that makes logical sense because rates of change are simply a reflection of basic math. So if you have an abysmal second quarter this year, then it's much more likely that you're going to have a very high positive growth in the second quarter of next year because you're comparing it to a much lower base, right? So to have the growth rates bounce back relatively quickly is not that difficult to do. And we've seen that consistently happen over the history of our economy. But the implications to business volumes and the amount of activity is a very different perspective. Despite the fact that we do have those rates of change bouncing back relatively quickly, our main position is that it's going to take some time, somewhere between 2 to 3 years, for us to get to pre-Black Swan levels of activity. It's not going to be a very quick rebound. And so when I talk about most of the company projections that we're issuing right now, we don't have a lot of the businesses coming back to the type of level of revenues that they witnessed in late 2019 and early 2020 until 22 or even 23 in some cases. Mm-hmm. So I think the main message that I would try to convey to your audience is that you need to be temperate. You need to understand that it's going to take some time. It's not going to be getting back to business as usual very quickly. And that is simply a function, again, of it takes time to dig out of that hole. Underlying all of that is the huge amount of uncertainty relating to the vaccine, right? I mean, we really can't get back to any sense of normalcy until not only is there a vaccine in place, but we actually have it widely distributed to the population. And there are so many complexities surrounding that I don't even know where to begin talking about it. But it's everything ranging from the ingredients going into the vaccine. Some of the vaccine candidates are made from the stomach lining of a llama. Others are from the bark of a tree that's harvested in Peru only during the kind of warm summer months. And it depends on which one gets approved before we can start to think about the implications to mass scale manufacturing of that vaccine, right? The next layer is, how do we get enough doses out to the population given that not all vaccines work the same way? Some of the vaccines are going to be a one and done shot, right? Others are two separate injections 6 months apart. So how do we know which one of those is going to be the one that's approved and gets kind of disseminated to the population? And the third and final component of this, and the one that I think is the most fascinating, has to do with our actual willingness to take the vaccine when it becomes available. I saw a recent survey that said something like less than half of all Americans, for various reasons, some of them are obviously in the anti-vaccination camp, others think that we're sacrificing quality and are rushing through the process so they don't feel safe taking a vaccine that was really accelerated the way that we did with this one. And so what we're saying is, yeah, even if there is a vaccine and if we're able to make enough of it, we don't know how many people are going to take that vaccine. So again, going back to my original point, I would say you've got to temper your expectations for getting back to normalcy, if by normal you mean kind of the levels of general economic activity that we saw in that late 2019, early 2020 timeframe before the Black Swan events took place.
Interesting. So it's almost like you're saying that it's like a little bit of a checkmark recovery.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think you can certainly do. I think that what we've seen is a relatively robust rebound because again, the effect that that closing down of the economy had in March and April, there's nothing like that on record. We've never seen anything like that happen. Yeah. So for example, GDP contracted by such a large amount that essentially wiped out 5 years of growth in one quarter. Right. But what we've also seen is a relatively sharp near-term rebound off of that level. Mm-hmm. But I think as we move into the future, it's going to be a little bit shallower of a growth rate. It's not going to be happening as at a robust pace now that we have started to open up the economy. It's going to be more gradual in nature, if you
will. Yeah. Interesting. I wonder if you have any thoughts on, you know, talk about black swans. This isn't a black swan, but this move that, you know, I'm based in New York, and as I'm sure you've heard, you know, so many, the idea of commercial real estate, at least in New York, with offices not returning to full capacity of having workers come in, and many people viewing that as something that is very much an antiquated model that will never come back at all. And so at that point, you know, many commercial real estate landlords will be on the hook for, they'll have a lot of inventory, they'll have fewer revenues, they'll be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of these are big companies, and it's certainly feasible that that could have a ripple effect, at least through local economies in big cities in the country. Is that something that you, that you're concerned about at all?
Well, certainly watching this very carefully. So there was a couple of points in that question that I wanted to address. First and foremost, I remain of the belief that we are social beings at heart, right, that we are not going to transition to this permanent work from home mantra. We might have a little bit more flexibility, which is what the millennials and Gen Zs have been asking for quite some time anyway. But people will go back to work. They want to be in the office. They want to be congregating with their peers. There's no replacing that. And we've seen that in our own business. We recognize that despite the fact that we're highly productive and efficient working from home, we're essentially kind of firing on 7 out of 8 cylinders because there's a je ne sais quoi. There's something missing from not being able to come together to brainstorm the same way that we were doing before. So I will say that some of the fears, I think, are a little bit likely overblown in terms of the sheer swing to the other side of the spectrum that this is going to cause. Hmm. However, having said that, I agree with your kind of indication that the non-residential construction markets, and in particular commercial office buildings, that kind of space, but also it extends to medical facilities and education construction. Those are going to be under fairly significant pressure. We believe that the next 2 years are down years for that construction segment, right? And with existing buildings, it's likely going to result in some significant pricing pressures over this time frame as well before the market can truly recover. But I do think that a recovery does occur because young people do not want to live in the suburbs. You want to live in the suburbs when you're in your mid-30s and you've got a young kid and a dog, so you want a yard for them to play in, right? Young people want to be mobile. They want to be in the thick of it. They want to be able to move about easily through whether it's Uber or public transportation system. So I think that further down the road, let's call it 3 to 5 years out, we largely see a recovery in that marketplace. But in the meantime, it's certainly going to be something that's going to be quite pressured. And my advice to companies, if they're renting a building, use this negativity and pessimism to negotiate better lease terms. Or even think about when you get to the low point, let's say 12 to 18 months from now, when there's been enough of a price pullback, if it makes sense, maybe even consider buying some of that non-residential real estate, because I think that in time it does come back. And if you can get a good enough valuation on it and get it at a discount, then that might not be a bad idea, especially if this is a building that you plan on keeping long-term anyway, right? If it's a like a warehouse or a distribution location that you know you're just going to be paying rent on this thing for the next 10 or 20 years, well, that might not be a bad idea to invest. We've always, and for a long time now, been very much positive on real estate investment overall. We think it should be a part of any managed portfolio structure. And so we think that this presents some really interesting opportunities. But again, it's all about location. It's all about making sure you're paying the right price and making sure that it's a sensible investment for you longer term, rather than just hoping to make a quick buck or two, because we're not exactly clear on how long this trend that I'm describing is going to take to play out.
Right. Yeah, right. Okay. Last question I have is, we've seen here, surprisingly to many, many companies that have really profited from the, not the pandemic itself, but all of the kind of derivative effects. And, you know, you think of a company like Zoom, right? Or even Amazon has done great, although not so much recently, but during this thing with people ordering stuff from home. Yep. You know, grocers that have gone into digital things have done quite well. Are there, as you have looked at forecasts and for businesses and such, are there any other sectors maybe of the economy or companies that you think could be in a position to benefit as this drags on?
Yeah, so I will say that there are sectors of the economy that are typically counter-cyclical, although I would say that right now that's not really the case. So the ones that in particular I'm thinking about are medical and aerospace. They tend to act in a counter-cyclical manner to the overall economy, but obviously what's going on with leisure travel right now is certainly affecting the Boeings and the Airbuses of the world. What we've got going on in the healthcare sector, which is people just kind of pushing back elective procedures and generally speaking, not wanting to go into healthcare facilities unless they absolutely need to. You know, we've seen surprisingly layoffs and really business closures in the medical sector, which is very, very uncharacteristic. So I think right now, the area where I am encouraged by, and I think longer term does present a really interesting opportunity, is defense. In particular, because that sector is not only not really driven by the economic cycle in general, it's driven in large part by budgets and appropriations and things that are kind of set in place and then don't change as a result of what's going on in the economy. But I also think that there's a very healthy amount of export activity being driven right now, because governments all around the world, as the world moves into this more inward-looking nationalistic posture, everyone is starting to realize Americans are pulling back. They're no longer going to be the police of the world, and we've got to start taking care of ourselves a little bit more than we have in the past when we relied on that American protection. You see this in Asia, you see this in the Middle East, you know, certainly the Europeans are becoming more aware of that. So I think that there are a lot of positive tailwinds for export sales of defense equipment. So, you know, I'm not going to give specific company names, but you're going to have an ample selection of businesses to choose from. I would say focus more on export-driven businesses rather than those serving the domestic market, because as you say, you know, as we get closer to the long-term trajectory, and as the government takes on more and more debt as part of the stimulus package, we're going to be looking for ways to cut back on spending. And so I think it's that export-driven side of the market that's going to be the more, let's call it the outperforming segment of within defense. So that would be my recommendations. Take a look at that. And of course, you know, I remain very positive on both tech and the market as a whole. One thing that really strikes me when I think about investing is that the stock market is the only vehicle that I know of that has a constant influx of funds going into it, no matter what's going on, right? I mean, every 2 weeks, people get paid, they're putting money into their 401ks, they're putting money into their IRAs. And that, I don't know of any other investment that has that baked in kind of feeding mechanism that continuously over, obviously, an extended period of time, but it generally pushes the valuations upward in a positive direction, right? We all know that the average growth rate for the S&P has been something like, what, 6 to 8%? If you look back far enough into the future. But the reality is, I think when it comes to investing specifically, my perspective is, how do you sleep better at night, right? Do you sleep better at night knowing that your money is in relatively safe haven investments, things like dividends and value funds, and you're not going to capture some of that massive upside you might see in stocks like Tesla, for example, or in Bitcoin, right? But you're okay knowing that your money is going to generally grow over time and it's going to kind of build that wealth nest egg for you. Or do you struggle with missing out on those run-ups, right? Do you want to be a little bit more aggressive and therefore are willing to take on that risk? And then that's how your investment strategy should be kind of built up, to position your preference for risk and the FOMO effect, right? You don't want to be missing out on one way or another. So that would be my recommendation is, especially for those of you that are investing with a longer term horizon, understand the general trend is one of upside movement. And that should continue no matter what happens. There's going to be periods of great volatility. I think a lot of times the stock market tends to overreact, especially as you talk about things that are like the presidential election. With so many people now joining the ranks of investors from their couch, right? And really driving their investment decisions based on what Jim Cramer happens to be saying on that particular talk show.
Hopefully not that many, but okay.
Well, I think what we've seen is with the closure of the sporting events and gambling and some of that, we've seen a lot of that money come into the market. I mean,
sure.
You know, so that's kind of
I think maybe Davy Day Trader is a better reference point.
Yeah, Davy Day Traders. There you go. I like to think of a guy sitting on his couch in his you know robe and eating popcorn while he's watching Jim Cramer and pulling the trigger on some stocks, right? So generally speaking, I'm positive on the market overall. Short term, certainly there is some downside risk because of the uncertainty out there right now. But I think if you align it with what we're expecting in the macro environment, which as I said is a continuation of the recovery trend, I think that over the next couple of years, the market should continue to do well, in my opinion.
Very good. Alex Chazowski, thank you so much for joining us. Maybe in closing, and I'll put this in the show notes as well, you can just tell our listeners how they can find a little bit more about you, websites, Twitter accounts, etc.
Absolutely, yeah. So the ITR Economics website is very logical and straightforward, itreconomics.com. There we have lots of different sections on there. You can look to hire us for our forecasting services. We do a lot of presentations, including to the financial and investment community. So if you'd like to get a little bit broader context of what we do, certainly feel free to contact us through the website. We are on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook, and my personal Twitter account is just at Chosofsky. So my first initial, last name. We're constantly putting out free content for you. So blog posts, opinion pieces, little audio and video files discussing the latest developments that are going on and giving you our opinion of what the implications of those developments are. So I certainly invite you to join us and follow us on the social media channels and hopefully get some better insights, because what we focus on is cutting through some of that noise that's out there right now, being data-driven decision makers and not being driven by emotion and anxiety. And so if you're looking for that kind of input, certainly please feel free to follow us.
Yeah, and certainly that'll be a better recourse than going to Jim Cramer or Davy Day Trader. But that's wonderful.
You like all the sound bites that he plays, you know, the noises. And
I view him as a contrarian, if anything, but yeah. Cool. Awesome. All right, Alex, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? the federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.